Hello again, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and this is my podcast. And as I mentioned before, I'm going to read to you from a novella in progress called There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow. Now is the best time of your life. Those of you who are familiar with my work will know that this is a reference to the Carousel of Progress in Disneyland and Walt Disney World in the 1964 World's Fair, and it is indeed a loving homage. I've just gotten off an airplane, so I'm a little jet-laggy. I came in from the East Coast, where I'd spent the weekend holed up and meeting about a new book project that I hope I can announce soon. I think it's going to happen. I sure hope so. Anyways, this story, There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow, Now is the Best Time of Your Life, is in four parts, and part one is called A Sparkling Jewel. I piloted the Mecca through the streets of Detroit, hunting wumpuses. The Mecca was a relic of the Mecca Wars, when the nation tore itself to shreds with lethal robots, and it had the weird, swirling lines of all evolutionary tech, channeled and chopped and counterweighted, like some freak dinosaur or a race car. I love the Mecca. It wasn't fast, but it had a fantastic ride, a kind of wobbly strut that was surprisingly comfortable and let me keep the big fore and aft guns on any target I chose, the sights gliding along on a perfect level even as the neck rocked from side to side. The pack loved the Mecca, too. All six of them, three aerial bots shaped like bats, two ground cover streaks that nipped around my heels, and a flea that bounded over the buildings, bouncing off walls and leaping from monorail track to rusting hover bus to balcony and back again. The pack's brains were back in Dad's house, in the old Comerica Park site. When I found them, they'd just been a pack of sick dogs dragging themselves through the ruined city, poisoned by old materiel. I had done them the mercy of extracting their brains and connecting them up to the house network. Now they were immortal, just like me, and they knew that I was their alpha dog. They loved to go for walks with me. I spotted the wumpus by the plume of dust it kicked up. It was well inside the perimeter, gnawing at the corner of an old satellite Ford factory, a building gone to magnificent ruin, all crumbled walls and crazy, unsprung machines. The structural pillars stuck up all around it, like columns around a Greek temple. The wumpus had the classic look. It stood about 8 feet tall, with 100 mouths on the end of its whipping tentacles. Its metallic finish was smeared with oily rainbows that wobbled as the dust swirled around it. The mouths whipped back and forth against the corner of the factory, taking chunks out of it. The chunks went into the hopper on its back and were broken up to their constituent atoms, reassembled into handy, safe, rich soil, and then ejected in a vertical plume that was visible even from several blocks away. Wumpuses don't put up much fight. They're reclamation drones, not hunter-killer bots, and their main mode of attack was to assemble copies of themselves out of dead buildings faster than I could squash them. They weren't much sport, but that was okay. There was no way Dad would let me put his precious Mecca at risk against any kind of big game. The pack loved hunting Wumpus, too. The air drones swooped around it in tight arcs. They were usually piloted by Pepe, the hysterical chihuahua, who loved to have 3 points of view. It fit right in with his distracted, hyperactive approach to life. The Wumpus didn't even notice the drones until one of them came in so low that it tore through the tentacles, taking three clean off and disordering the remainder. The other air drones did victory loops in the sky, and the flea bounded so high that it practically disappeared from sight, then touched down right next to the Wumpus. The attack was characteristic of Gretel, the Irish setter mix, who thought she was a kangaroo. The whole pack liked the flea, but Gretel was born to it. She bounced the Wumpus 6 times, knocking it back and forth like an air hockey puck, leaping free before it could bring its tentacles to bear on her. The ground effect bots reached the Wumpus at the same time, as I did. Technically, I was supposed to hang back out of range and get it with the Mecha's big guns to make sure that it didn't get a bite or two in on the Mecha's skin, scratching the finish, but that was no fun at all. I liked to dance with the Wumpus, especially when the pack was on it, all of us dodging in and out, snatching the Wumpus's tentacles, kicking it back and forth. The ground effect bots were clearly piloted by Ike and Mike, two dogs that had been so badly mutilated when I got them that I couldn't even guess at their breed. They must have been big beasts at one point. They were born to ground effect bots anyway, pulling the Wumpus around. The Wumpus was down to just a few tentacles now, and I could see into its hopper, normally obscured by the forest of waving arms and mouths. The hopper itself was lined with tentacles, but thin ones, whip-like, each one fringed with hairy cilia. The cilia branched and branched again, down to single-molecule pincers, each one optimized to break apart a different kind of material. I knew better than to reach inside that hopper with the mecha's fists. Even after I'd killed the Wumpus, the hopper would digest anything I fed it, including me. Its foot-spoked wheels spun madly as we batted it around like a cat playing with a mouse. They could get traction on anything, given enough time to get their balance, but we weren't going to give it the chance. The air drone snipped the last of the tentacles as I touched the control that whistled the pack back. They obediently came to my heels, and I put the Wumpus in my sights. The Wumpus seemed to sense what was coming. It stopped struggling and settled down on the feet of its wheels. I methodically blew apart its hoppers with my depleted uranium guns, chipping away at it, blowing it open, cilia waving and spasming. Now the Wumpus was just a coil of metallic skin and logic, with 100 wheels, naked and stripped. I used the rocket launcher on it and savored the debris fountain that rose from it. Sweet. Jimmy Yensid, you are cruel and vile. The voice bounced off the walls of the ruined buildings around me, strident and shrill. I rotated the mecha's cowl and scanned the ground. There she was, standing on the top of a dead hover bus, a spider goat behind her on a tether. I popped the cowl and shinned down the mecha, using the grippy hand and toe holds that tried to conform to my grasp. "Hello, Lacey," I called. "You're looking very pretty today." Dad had always taught me to talk to girls this way, though there weren't many meat girls in my world, just the ones I saw online and, of course, the intriguing women of the Carousel of Progress, back in the center of Comerica Park. And it was true, Lacey Treehugger was ever so pretty, with a face as round as a pie plate and lips like a drawn-up bow. Talking to Lacey was as forbidden as destroying the mecha, maybe more so, but Dad could tell if the mecha got scratched, and he had no way of finding out if I had been passing the time of day with pretty Lacey. She was taller than me now, which was only to be expected, because she was not immortal, and so she was growing at the regular speed while I was going to stick to my present neat little size for a good while yet. I didn't mind that she was taller either. I liked the view. "Hello, hello," I said as I scaled the hover, coming up to stand next to her. "Hello," I said to the spider goat, holding out the flat of my hand for it to sniff. It brayed at me and menaced me with its horns. "Come on, Louisa, play nice." She tugged on the goat's lead, a zizzing spool of something that felt as soft as felt, but which could selectively tighten at the loop end when the goat got a little too edgy. "This isn't Louisa, Jimmy. This is Moldavia. Louisa died last week." She glared at me. "I'm sorry to hear it," I said. "She was a good goat." "She died from eating bad sludge," Lacey said. "Ah, well, that explained it. Lacey's people hated Dad's preserve here in the old city of Detroit. They hadn't made the Wumpuses, but they fully supported their work. The Treehuggers wanted all of the old industrial world converted back to the kind of thing you could let a goat eat without worrying about it dropping dead, turning to plastic, or averting its digestive tract. "You should keep a closer eye on your goats, Lacey," I said. "It's not safe for them to wander around here." "Well, it would be if you'd leave off hunting those innocent Wumpuses. The way you took that poor thing apart, it was sickening." "Lacey, it's a machine. It doesn't have feelings. I was just having a little fun." "Sickening," she repeated. She had her short hair in tiny braids today, which is one of the many ways I love to see it. Each braid was tipped with a tiny, glittering bead of fused soil, stuff that her people collected as a reminder of the bad old days. "How's your parents?" She didn't manage to hide her smile. "Their weirdness is terminal. This week they decided that we were going to try to sell spider goat silk to India, and I'm all like, 'India? Are you crazy? What does India want with our textiles? They don't even need clothes there anymore, not since the Desi Doties came out.'" Desi Doties were self-cleaning, self-replicating, and could reconfigure themselves. No one who made dollars could afford them. They were denominated in rupees only. And they went, "Have you seen how the rupee is trading today?" So they're all over eBay, posting auction listings in broken Hindi. I'm all like, "You know India is the world's largest English-speaking nation, right?" I shook my head. "You're right. Terminally weird." She gave me a playful shove. "You're one to talk. At least mine are human." So technically it was true. Dad refused to call himself a human anymore. Ever since he attained immortality, decades before I was born, he'd called himself a transhuman. But when he said he wasn't human, it was a boast. When Lacey said it, it sounded like an insult. It bugged me. Dad didn't want me deracinating myself with Lacey. Lacey didn't trust me because I wasn't a real human. It wasn't like I wanted to be a mayfly like the Treehuggers were, but I still hated it when Lacey looked down her nose at me. really do hate the way you take those wumpuses apart," she said. "It gives me the creeps. I know they're not alive, but you seem to be enjoying it." "The pack enjoys it," I said, gesturing at my robots, who were wrestling each other around my feet. "It's in their nature to hunt." She looked away. "I don't like them either," she said, barely above a whisper. "Come on," I said. "They're better off now than they were when I found them. At least I haven't screwed around with their germplasm. I'm just using technology to let them be better dogs. Not like Louisa there." I pointed to the spider goat. "Moldavia," she said. I knew I had her there. I pressed my advantage. "You think she enjoys giving silk? Somewhere in her head, she knows she's supposed to be full of milk." Lacey looked out over the ruins of Detroit. "It's pretty around here," she said. "Yeah," I said. It was. The ruins were glorious. They were all I'd ever known, except for flyovers and the Zep. Michigan countryside was pastoral and picturesque, but it wasn't anything so magnificent as Detroit's ruins. So much ambition. It made me proud to be transhuman. I wish you guys would stop trying to take it away from us. This is how conversation with Lacey always went, each of us picking fights with the other. It was all we knew, the best way we had to relate. Neither of us really meant it. It was just an excuse to stand close enough to her to count the hairs on her arms, to watch the sun through her eyelashes. She looked at me. "It's not like you let anyone else come by and see it anyway. You just hoard it all to yourself. You come by whenever you want. What's the problem? You treat it like your own private playground. You know how many people could live here?" "None," I said. "It would kill them within a week." I was immune, thanks to my transhuman liver. Dad's liver wasn't quite so trick, but he made do by eating cultured yogurt filled with microbes that kept him detoxed. He said it was a small price to pay for continued residence in his museum. "You know what I mean," she said, socking me again. "Let the wumpuses do their thing, turn this whole place back into forests, grow some tree houses." "How many? 1 million? 2 million? "Sure," I said, "provided you didn't care about destroying all this history." "There are billions of blown-out steel-belted radials," she said, "all over the world. What the hell makes yours so special?" "What if this was ancient Rome?" I said. "What if we were all sitting around thinking about pounding down all those potsherds, and you were all like, 'Jimmius Jensidus, why are you saving all those potsherds? Rome is full of them. They're a health hazard. The centurions keep cutting their feet on them." "You're a total idiot," she said. We got to this point in every discussion. Half the time I called her an idiot, half the time it was the other way around. We sat down on the bus, and she put her arm around me. I leaned in for my kiss. Dad would totally splode if he knew. Deracination. "Sorry, Dad." She kissed me slowly, with a lazy bit of tongue that made the hair on my neck stand up. She was probably getting a little old for me, but I found that I quite liked older women. She broke it off and sighed. "You're so young," she said. "We can't keep doing this." "I'm 2 months older than you," I said, baiting her. I knew what she meant. "You used to be. These days, it's like you're 10. I'm almost 14, Jimmy. So go kiss some tree-hugger boys on the spider goat farm," I said. She sighed again. "Are you really happy here? Are you happy where you are?" "I'm happy enough. It's peaceful. Boring." "Yeah," she said. "Well, it's not boring around here. Going out with Dad is awesome. Dad collected pieces for his museum from all over the world. We'd gone to France together the year before to get the girl and the Sultan's elephant from Marseilles. The semi-robotic puppets were 11 meters tall, and we'd stashed them in the high school gym near the bus station. We couldn't work them out on our own. They needed a crew of 20 or more, but I was working on training the pack to help out. Trying, anyway. Pepe kept trying to eat the elephant." "But you're all alone, and your dad is so weird." "He's weird, but he's a lot of fun. I won't live here forever anyway. Once I'm post-pube, I'm going on a vision quest. It's part of the package. Then I'll find somewhere to settle down." "You got it all figured out, huh?" Pepe had been circling high overhead as we chatted, occasionally dipping down to play with the ground effect critters. Now all three of his drones lofted high, making wide circles. That was a signal that he was seriously freaking out. I stood up to get a better look at him, Lacey grabbing at my hand. I followed the wide, sweeping curves of the drones, turning to watch, and saw two of them get shot out of the sky, 1-2, just like that, disappearing in a hail of debris. Lacey squeezed my hand. "Kurzweil on a crutch," I breathed. I headed for the Mecca, but Lacey wouldn't let go of my hand. "Come on," I said, looking into her scared face. "You ride shotgun. I'll get you home safe." She shook her head. Her eyes were white. The pack was going crazy around us, nipping at our heels, racing in circles. The flea was springing high, high, higher. The crack of artillery. A flight of rockets screamed overhead, then touched down somewhere. The sound was incredible, like nothing I'd ever heard, and the earth shook so hard that I slipped and went down on one knee. "Come on," I said to Lacey. "Get in." I grabbed for the bottom rung of the mecha's handholds and felt it grip me back. I looked over my shoulder. Lacey was hugging the goat. Damn it, the goat. "We'll take her too," I said. I reached for the goat, but she butted at me and shied back. "Lacey, you can't stay here," I said. There was the rattle of small arms, another volley of rockets. A cloud of dust boiled down the street. I barely managed to yank my shirt over my head before it overtook us, blotting out the sky, filling every pore with gray, shattered concrete. It was like a wumpus plume gone metastatic, filling the entire world. I tugged my shirt back into place and looked around. Lacey was gone. I jumped down from the hover and ran around the bus. The pack were everywhere around me. I tried to whistle them up and sent them in a search pattern for Lacey and the goat, but I needed the mecha for that. I wasn't thinking straight. I turned and crouched down and put my face in my hands and breathed deeply. Then I stood up, thumped the ground effect critters behind the ears, and climbed into the mecha and sealed the cowl, turning on air, radiation, and flashbang filters at max. The screens were all going bonkers. I took another deep breath. First things first, Pepe was still up there. I dropped his sensorium onto the side screens, dialed back to when he first started to circle, absently watching the attacks unfold. On the main screens, I put up the view from the ground effects and the flea and told them to fan out and look for Lacey. Pepe had been watching the attack when Lacey went missing, so his rewind wasn't any help there, but at least I could watch the attack that had unfolded. There were 8 mechas in formation, coming across the river from where Windsor used to be. It was our least guarded flank. We counted on the river as the first line of defense. If I was planning an invasion, that's where I'd strike, too. The mechas were smaller than mine. They were barely bigger than their pilots, more powered armor than vehicles. I recognized them as coming from the earliest years of the mecha wars, whereas my mecha was the last generation produced, a juggernaut that stood 4 times larger than them. The pack hadn't found Lacey. I looked at the screens and decided that Lacey had gone to ground somewhere, hiding in a ruined building. Fine, she'd be as safe there as she was anywhere. I began to run for Windsor. Dad wouldn't answer his phone. I dropped mine into the mecha's hopper and told it to keep on redialing him. I kept getting the voicemail. "You have reached Robin Yensid and the Detroit Conservation Zone. We are happy to hear from another telephone user. Your choice of communications technology is appreciated. Help keep the telephone alive! That said, I can't come to my phone right now. Leave me a message and I'll phone you back." My mecha ran full tilt, bent almost double. The cockpit remained level in the end of the mecha's flexible stock of a neck, rolling silently from side to side to keep from upsetting me. It didn't even spill my coffee. Who'd be attacking Detroit? Dad believed that the Wumpuses were made by some kind of co-op in San Diego, deep greens who'd made viral bots and released them into the wild more than 10 years before. I checked out the co-op's presence a couple of times, and it was mostly arguments about who was supposed to be tucking the oxen into bed each night, what kind of stories were appropriate to read to their calves. Apparently, the co-op had changed the focus after their Wumpus phase and gone into farming. In any event, I didn't think that they were the kind of gang that could send 8 members across the continent in mechas to make sure that the last real city got plowed under by Wumpuses. The mecha told me that it had the 8 enemy aircraft in range of its missiles. I stopped and dropped the third leg for stability, and I sighted on the flank closest to me. I thought I'd pick them off in order, closest to furthest, and hope that the far ones wouldn't even notice what I was up to until I'd already done it. I told the missile which mecha to attack. It was purple, and Pepe's imaging showed a driver behind the cowl that was about Dad's size, though I couldn't tell the sex or age. I put my finger over the button and got ready to press it, but I didn't push the button. I had killed 1 million Wumpuses. I had put some dogs out of their misery, beasts too far gone to join the pack. I had swatted flies and exploded mosquitoes with lasers, but I'd never killed a human being. Technically, I was a transhuman, so was this still murder? My thumb thought so. Dad's voicemail came up again. The mecha closest to me was swiveling towards me. I could hear its radar scattering off my armor. I hit the button, and my mecha recoiled as the rocket screamed away from the frame on my mecha's chest. The missile corkscrewed through a tracker-confounding set of spirals, shaking off the radar chaff as it went. The chaff was propelled as well, and it too moved through corkscrews, so that even I couldn't figure out which was the real missile and which were the drones. Then, the moment of contact. The real missile hit the mecha dead center. I watched its nose cam as it kissed the chest plate, seeing the mouth of the man, or woman, inside, shot up through the clear shield. The mouth made a perfect O. Then the chest cam stopped working. I looked out with my naked eyes in time to see the mecha come apart in an expanding cloud of debris. Not all the debris was made of metal. There was a red mist in the air. Something wet hit the ground. It must have been part of a person once. Now it looked like roadkill, like the dogs that couldn't make it into the pack. It was a murderer. The person inside that mecha might have been an immortal like me, or she might have been made into an immortal like Dad. Might have lived forever. The other mechas were targeting me now, three moving to flank me, two grasping forearms and locking at the ankles to make a single unit, which rose into the air on rotors over their shoulders. I had already armed the remaining missiles and targeted the four closest to me, without even thinking of it. I played a lot of mecha sims on slow days, sometimes using the console in front of the huge chunky TV in the living room of the fourth scene of the Carousel of Progress. Dad did not approve of this, so I didn't tell him. I launched the battery and used the recoil time to bring the evaders up to nominal. This was the mecha's gymnastics program, a set of heavily randomized backsprings and twirls and such. Supposedly impossible for a targeting system to get a lock on, but nevertheless calculated to keep the enemy in range at all times. Theoretically, the brave pilot, ahem, me, could continue to harass and kill the enemy while pulling 4Gs through a set of acrobat maneuvers. The evaders were better than the carny rides that Dad kept refurbishing and riding and running, but truth be told, they'd never failed to make me puke. But as the missiles screamed toward the enemy mechas and the airborne unit bore down on me, big guns blazing, puking seemed like a sensible alternative to dying. I hit the evaders and dug in. I'd ridden the evaders dozens of times, but this was the first time I kept my eyes open. The nausea didn't rush up and overtake me. Instead, I remained utterly focused on the enemy craft, my gaze locked on them as my body rocked and flipped. My missiles had taken down two more. The other missiles had disappeared, either foiled by an anti-targeting system or knocked out of the sky. I threw more bad stuff in their direction, using the conventional depleted uranium rounds as the flips and turns brought me into range. The evaders were hard on the mecha's power cells, so the maneuvers only ran for a few minutes, but it felt like hours. When we ground to a halt, my mecha and I, we were much closer to the enemy craft than before. There had been eight of them. Now there were three. The two that had taken to the sky were lying in a twisted wreckage near me. The pack were barking like crazy, filling the cockpit with their alerts. The flea was bouncing up and down on the downed aerial unit, savaging the pilots through their cowls. It kept replaying the video of the kill, the flea leaping up to land on the rotor's mast, biting down on the drive shaft and hanging on as the rotors bent, collided, spun away, the flea bounding free of the dying craft as it spun out and spiraled down. The remaining mecha were moving with more discipline and purpose than their brethren had. I no longer had the advantage of surprise. These three were taking cover behind Dad's favorite office tower, a big white marble thing done in a style that Dad called deco. They lobbed missiles over the building, apparently using orbitals or something stratospheric for targeting. Two could play at that game. I whistled up the flea and Pepe and sent them around to the back of the tower, giving me some guidance for my own targeting system. My mecha knew well enough to automatically interface with the lads, tying them straight into its guidance systems. I fired some grenades at the parking structure opposite their covering building, letting the mecha calculate the bank shot so that they bounced off and landed amid the enemies. Two more down, and the other two were on the move, streaking out from behind the building. Holy crap, they were fast! They fired in unison at me, letting me have it with guided missiles, grenades, conventional ammo. I tried evasive maneuvers, but it was no good. They shot the mecha's left leg out from under it, and I tumbled. and kept rolling. The mecha wars were vicious, and once a Ronin mecha was in the field, it might go months without a resupply or maintenance. These bastards kept coming at you no matter what, pulling themselves along on whatever limbs were left until there was nothing left to fight with. My mecha came down in a three-pointed stance, like one of the ground effect vehicles, like it was doing yoga, coming into a downward dog. The cowl swung around, and I was upright again, atop the thorax of my newly bug-like fighting machine. The ground effect puppies nipped at my heels as I scuttled towards the enemy, closing. There was nothing but conventional ammo now, so it was close fighting. In a pinch, my mecha could uproot a building and clobber them with it. 2 minutes before, I'd been agonizing about becoming a murderer. Now I wanted to tear their legs off and beat them to death with them. The dogs wanted to do their thing, and I gave them the nod over my command channel. The entire pack converged on one of the two mechas, the closer one, grabbing its limbs and tumbling it to the ground, rending the metal away from the cowl. I actually heard the pilot scream, and it made me grin. That left one more. He, it was a he, I was close enough to see that now, had planted himself in a fencer's stance, presenting the side of his body to me as he raised his near hand straight out to me, the maws of his guns yawning towards me. His other arm was curled across his chest, fanning up and down, trying to keep me in his sights at all times. I scuttled my mecha forward, taking cover when I could, using trucks and houses, even a beautiful neon sign that Dad always stopped to admire when we were out for walks. It exploded and came down with a series of crystal, tinkling sounds. I got off as many shots at it as I could, but it was fresh, with a seemingly endless supply of ammo to harry me with whenever I tried to target it. Then it got me, bouncing a grenade off the ground 10 yards ahead of me, sending it sailing right into the mecha's midsection, so that I flipped and rolled and rolled and rolled. Now I felt nauseated. When I finally stopped rolling, I knew I was about to die. The mecha's lights were all dark, all systems down. Dad was going to kill me. I chuckled and groaned. My ribs, pressed into the crash harness, felt like a handful of dried twigs rattling against one another. I struggled to release the webbing as I punched the trigger for the charges that blew out the cowl. I would die on my feet. I got out of the mecha just in time to see the ground effect puppy streaking toward the enemy mecha, who was raising his guns for the triumphant kill. I saw in an instant what they intended, turned my face away just as they collided with him, exploding in a shower of hot metal. I dived back into the cowl, heedless of my ribs, and curled into a ball as the debris rained down around me. When I straightened up, the remaining mecha was a twisted, blackened wreck, streaked with red. The two doggies had gone suicide bomber when they saw that my life was endangered, blowing themselves up and taking the remaining enemy with them. Good doggies. When I got home, I'd give their brains some extra endorphins. They'd earned it. Of course, finding them some more bots to pilot wasn't going to be easy. Dad's museum city was cratered with the aftermath of my battle. Buildings razed, fires blazing. I took a tentative step away from the wreckage of my mecha and stumbled, gasping at the pain in my ribs. Then I remembered that I left my phone in the cockpit and had to crawl back in to get it. It was still redialing Dad, still getting his voicemail. A part of my brain knew that this meant that he was in deep trouble somewhere in Detroit. That part seemed to be locked in a padded room, judging by its muffled cries. The part in charge didn't worry about Dad at all. Dad was fine, he was back at Comerica waiting for me, and he was going to be so pissed about the mecha. It was the last of its kind, and Dad never tired of reminding me. And several of his favorite buildings were in ruin. This was going to be ugly. I pocketed the phone and whistled up the pack. It was just the flea and Pepe now. Pepe perched on the flea's shoulder and let me pet his carapace. I tested my legs. Wobbly but serviceable. Without the mecha, it'd be harder to talk to the pack, but they'd be okay on their own. They had good instincts, my pups. Normally it was a 10-minute walk from the Ambassador Bridge to Comerica. Hell, the People Mover monorail still went most of the way, but I could see a People Mover from where I stood, and it was stock still, motionless on the track. Someone had cut its power. I took some tentative steps. My ribs groaned and grated, and I gasped and nearly fell over. The flea bounced to me and nuzzled at me. I leaned on it as it trundled forward slowly. This was going to take a lot more than 10 minutes. If only Dad would pick up the phone. He could come and get me.